I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey guys, you ever wonder what Phil and I wear while we podcast? You can find out if you join our Patreon. We'll also be talking about the films of 1989, but that's definitely less important than seeing our Zoom backgrounds, our headphone choices, and our sweatshirts.
It's true. It's true. You'll get to see all the various pieces of artwork that I have framed on my office wall, and you can see Kenny's garden, sort of. So that's something. That's exciting.
It's a hanging garden.
It's a hanging garden. But perhaps more important than anything, we are doing this Patreon to cover the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, with amazing guests like Tom Meissen, Liz Hanna, Joanna Robinson, Brian Cogman, Chuck Hayward. You can sign up at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. And for $5, you'll get access to all the audio of these fantastic episodes. For a few bucks more, you'll get video as well of our 99 and 89 episodes. And perhaps, most importantly, you'll be supporting us so we can just keep making podcast content for you guys.
Podcast Like It. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999. I'm your host, Phil Iskov, and with me today is Liz Hanna, writer of The Post, Longshot, Mindhunter. She's here to talk with me today about Mr. Willis of Ohio. But before we get to that, did you watch this show live in 99, or was this a show that you came to a little later, or how did that work for you?
It's funny because The West Wing is such a massive influence on me as a writer and a storyteller that I feel like I've always watched it, but I actually didn't watch it when it was on. My mom watched it. I came to it later. My mom watched it and like I was a teenager and so it was like, it was just, like, I don't know. I was sort of not, I just wasn't smart enough, I guess, to watch it. I was like, I was down to watch some other stuff. So no, I did not watch it while it was on, but I think the first time I saw it was when I was in college and somebody had the DVD box sets. And so I watched those and then I became wildly obsessed. And now I watch it at least once a year.
You know, it's funny. To be clear, I didn't watch it live probably until season 3 is my guess. I had friends that watched it. Similarly, I mean, I was 19 in 99. I wasn't an avid television watcher. I had my shows that I really loved, but by and large, I certainly didn't watch as much TV as I watch now. But similar to you, once it got its hooks in me, now it's like, it feels like it's part of my DNA.
Yeah, it's very strange. Like I rewatched the episode we're going to talk about earlier this morning to just prepare. And like, I sort of don't have to pay attention to it because like, I know what it is. Like, yep, I was like, yep. Do I have to rewatch it? And I was like, well, I'll prepare. I'll rewatch it. But it was like on my iPad. And I was like, yeah, I know what's going to say. And like, Eric Balfour is going to show up at some point and he's going to have blow in his pocket. Like, it was like this weird, it's this weird, like, yep. Yep. And there's a rhythm to how it goes. It is like, I don't know. It's very much in my, yeah, it's like, feels like it's in my DNA as well.
So, I have to ask, you are a very sort of politically active person. You know, I feel mm-hmm. as though, at least through your social media, mm-hmm. how do you feel this show? Because there are people that feel like the show has had an impact on the way politics is perceived, for good and for bad. Mm-hmm. And in terms of the expectations of what people think civil service is supposed to be about, or mm-hmm. or at least what the sort of consequences or what have you, the pros and cons of that. Do you feel, and I don't hold this against the show, just to be clear, there are some people that feel as though, you know, Trump is because of the West Wing. I think that's a false equivalency.
Well, let's calm down.
but I do think that just in terms of just how people sort of perceive politics, do you think, mm-hmm. I think it's had a lot of pros, it's had some cons as well, but how do you feel the show holds up today versus when you first watched it?
I find it really difficult to watch today because, it was a better time then. Like we could, look at, you know, Jed Bartlett and be like, well, that's ideal. And that's a president. And when you're looking at a television character as being more presidential than the person who's in the White House, that's wildly disconcerting. You know, I think it's a really interesting thing to talk about. You know, I Sorkin has spoken a lot about this, I think, particularly in the past few years, as people talk about like a reboot or what it is. And, yeah. You know, in 99, when this was happening, you know, it was right before W. Yeah. The Democrats were still in power. There was still, you know, we were post Clinton impeachment, but still like gripping to this ideal of kind of like a Camelot style, you know, White House. And then it sort of was instantly a downfall. It was like, you know, the first half of season one is like, this is great. And then the second half is like, well, we're in the shitter. So this is terrible. So I think it's really interesting sort of to look at it with, I mean, it's, I guess it's season two that sort of hits right when W is elected and it's, you know, sort of been up and down ever since. But yeah, I don't know. It's really weird to look at it back and forth. I think, there's also a lot that feels very similar, this episode in particular, you know, like how Republicans and Democrats play the same game and it's very sidesy, it's very partisan. You know, I think there's a really interesting moment where Toby admits about the partisanship and how, you know, everyone does have their own goals. The thing for me that frankly is very applicable to now that I think is, I always find slightly silly that when people talk about it is like, oh, you know, now everybody's like, let's reach across the aisle and talk to each other. And it's like, well, no, that's not necessarily possible with everybody because you're talking to people who think that COVID-19 doesn't exist and they've been elected to Congress, you know, like yeah, you're talking to, it's not like you're, I mean, even in Sorkin's world of the West Wing, Republicans were idealized, you know, I mean, and there was a belief that, Republicans and Democrats all had the same goals, which is democracy and fighting for Americans and belief in a better system for everyone. And some believe in more government, some believe in lesser government and all of these different values, but they're still fighting for the same thing. Whereas now, like, who the fuck knows what anybody's fighting for? Yep. And all we're doing is tearing each other apart. And, you know, we're excited when the Supreme Court rules for, you know, the First Amendment on like the most obvious First Amendment case of all time. Because it's, you know, it's scary. It's really scary. So I don't know. It's like, it's very, very long-winded thing. It's like very difficult for me to watch it now because it's so different.
Yeah. I mean, it's.
But I would not blame it for Donald Trump. I feel like.
No, I mean, I guess it's more that people felt like, I've just read a lot of articles about, you know, the Obama White House and whether or not there was sort of this idealistic perception of what he could and couldn't do because of sort of fictionalized White Houses. And since then, we've seen Scandal and we've seen House of Cards and we've seen these television shows that show perhaps a more accurate representation of how cutthroat it is. This is a very idealized perspective of politics. And I mean, you've obviously, you know, you wrote The Post, you've seen sort of, you obviously know quite a bit about real politics and what actually happened. And there is a lot of people watched this show during the pandemic. It was a bomb. It was a very sort of, there's something very calming and lovely about how melodious everybody speaks and everyone's very smart and everyone has, you know, the best of intentions, save for Mandy, it seems. But I mean, ultimately...
Poor Mandy.
R.I.P. Mandy. But I guess it's just, it's interesting how you find it difficult to watch. I found it difficult to watch and then weirdly rewatched most of it during the election as like a way to sort of help me cope with what was going on.
I did too, actually. I watched season one during the election and I found it, it's like comfort food. It's like a security blanket and it at some point makes me feel like a rational human being where I can sort of watch The West Wing and I'm like, okay, well, this was the most popular show on television by the millions for like 2 years. So that wasn't just Democrats. You know what I mean? Like there is something to like a lot of Democrats don't own fucking TVs. So like, you know, it's like, it's not just the liberals who are watching this show.
Sure, sure.
So there's something like that is, that makes me feel better about that, thinking that.
Sure.
I don't know, there is like a core group of this country that still believes in these values. But yes, I mean, I think it's a very idealized version. And it was an idealized version in 99, you know, and it was an idealized version, it's an idealized version in 2021. And, but I think, you know, at its, which again, I think Sorkin has talked about, but it's interesting that we feel like in 99, it was more acceptable. Whereas like this was his security blanket was writing about it this way. And I think it's because things have just gotten so much worse that we're like, yeah, take us back to 99. That sounds great.
For sure. It's quaint, quite frankly. Yeah. Like the scandals that exist within the West Wing are, especially considering what we went through during the Trump administration, feel just downright like quaint. It is interesting. I mean, I think that this episode, I'm very excited to talk about this episode with you because I think there's a lot of really interesting stuff to unpack. I think there's some really great classic West Wing stuff, and then there's some stuff that feels very of its time in terms of how it sort of navigated some of the racial stuff, there's like homophobia. There's a whole bunch of stuff within the argument in the Georgetown bar, which we'll get into.
Yeah, the homophobia stuff in the end was, I was like, well, this is the most 1999 part of this series that I've potentially ever seen. That was like, ooh. Yeah.
So let me just give a brief synopsis. Toby and Mandy worked to convince some congressmen, including the nervous Mr. Willis, who assumed his late wife's office, to approve a commerce bill that includes a vital census counting provision. The president's daughter, played by Elizabeth Moss, gets into an ugly argument in a Georgetown bar along with Josh and Sam. Elsewhere, CJ swallows her pride and asks Sam for help to understand the basic components of the administration's stance on random census taking in 2000. And a peeved President Bartlett scolds Leo when he learns Leo's wife has left him. Mr. Willis of Ohio aired on November 3rd, 99. It was written by Aaron Sorkin, directed by Christopher Maziano. 13.37 million viewers turned into this episode.
That's the most 1999 thing I've ever heard. Like, what? That's insane. Yeah. If you get like 1.2, you're like, it's a hit. It's great.
I mean, over 13 million people tuned in. Like we didn't have DVRs. People were in front of their television sets for a time slot to watch a television show.
Yes. It's crazy. That is to me the most, putting the politics aside, that is like as somebody who works in television is mind blowing to me. Like a 3.1 is like, you're a fucking hit. You should just, you're ready. Your show's about to go on for the next 6 years. Like, have a great time. It's crazy.
13 million people, but just to blow your mind even more, I did an episode with Brian Cogman.
I have movies that I have made that 13 million people have not watched. That's the comparison I can make to this. That is insane to me. Okay,
and not just haven't watched ever, like let alone like never, at one specific time.
Never watched, like never seen. Yeah. That's Bananas. Okay, sorry.
Go ahead. What I was going to say is I did an episode with Brian Cogman on an ER episode from season 6 that aired in 99. A somewhat random November episode that over 30 million people watched. Like, it's one of those things where you're just like, this was a different time. Like, people will never know this level of commitment to a television show.
No, I mean, you even look at it now with sports. Like, I'm a big sports fan, and you look at it like with basketball rating, you know, like it's the NBA final, Eastern Western playoffs, Conference Finals, right? Now, and like, yeah, it's a playoffs, and like, you look at the ratings for that and they're incredibly low. You look at the ratings for the Super Bowl and they're incredibly low, and like, those are live events that you don't typically DVR to watch. You know, it's not like this is something that I'm like, oh, let me go check out Ted Lasso tomorrow. Like, it's sure. You know, and the fact that 13 million people watched this episode of television is like mind blowing to me. Okay,
you're absolutely it. It's really interesting too. You mentioned the Super Bowl, and obviously the post Super Bowl slot for a television mm-hmm. show is still a coveted thing, mm-hmm. but I mean, it's not even remotely close to where it used to be. I mean, you used to have, you know, an episode of Friends would air after the Super Bowl and 60 or 70 million people would watch that episode of television, which obviously is insane. But now it's just like people don't have the patience. To your point, people DVR things. They watch the clips on ESPN the next day or mm-hmm. whatever the case might be. It's different. I mean, I don't know that it's necessarily worse, just to be clear. It's just mm-hmm. to your point, pretty mind-blowing to think of something that seismic. And this absolutely. Show was that. I want to read just a couple, two quick quotes from Aaron Sorkin. He said, "You say the word census and people fall asleep. It's a questionnaire. Turns out it's terribly important." I think is very interesting. But Aaron Sorkin seems to be a guy who a lot of people do a lot of research for him, and he mm-hmm. learns a lot of things as he's mm-hmm. writing things. So his characters sound very smart. Mm-hmm. I'm not convinced that Aaron Sorkin has the most well-rounded knowledge of things, which I think is quite interesting. It's not to take anything away from his writing.
But I feel like that's most writers. Like, I spent, 3 years of my life very enmeshed in like 4 months that surround, not even 4 months, like 4 weeks that surrounded 1971. If you asked me like any other particulars of 1971, I could not tell you anything. But those 4 weeks, I could probably tell you every single, or I could have until it like vacated my brain 3 years ago. But like, I could tell you every intimate detail of that experience and those 4 weeks. But so, yeah, I mean, I feel like as writers, it's like, I have to research this really important detail.
Right.
I'm not going to really look at anything else about it. Like, how much
but don't
of this
you also feel like, do you also feel as though, I don't know if you're this way, but all that research might not manifest itself in dialogue or in events that happen. Just to have it in the back of your head informs the way that you write a character, you write a scene. And I think that Aaron Sorkin and this show in particular is so great at explaining things in a way that is digestible by the public. He's always been very good at that. Like a lot of his obviously, Moneyball or Social Network, whatever the case might be, in terms of just making sure that the audience is able to lock into what's going on. Otherwise, obviously you're nowhere. And Allison Janney says, "I thought Aaron was crazy. I read that and I was like, well, this is going to be the most boring thing ever. And then we did it. We had such a good time. I learned right along with CJ, as did my friends who watched the show. And now I can guarantee you everyone who saw that show is going to fill out their census because they see how it works." I love how idealistic that is. We can obviously see that didn't exactly play out. But I do think that I have learned a lot of things through The West Wing. I don't know mm-hmm. if you can say that. I mean, obviously, it's a really interesting thing to think about people learning from a fictionalized political universe. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I do think that there's a lot of stuff to be taken away from that. I want to walk through the storylines sort of mm-hmm. individually rather than kind of walking through the plot.
Sure.
The first one, I guess the easiest one, and also a little bit problematic, is the Bartlett Leo stuff. Mm-hmm. I found it really interesting, and I'm obviously very interested in your thoughts in terms of the Leo Bartlett relationship is a fascinating one. It does feel brotherly, mm-hmm. but it also feels like Leo keeps Bartlett in check.
Yeah, I mean, I think their relationship over the course of the series is one that I think is sort of the heart of the show. I don't think that's a monumental or like, massive realization to yeah, I don't think that's a hot take to come out with. And I you know, I don't want to get into like sort of where that relationship goes, because I think that's, mm-hmm. you know, it's really sort of hard to watch that in particular, you know, towards the end. But I think the first season, what's so interesting is how much it's focused on them. And there's a really great moment, which I think happens either right before this episode or after this episode, when it's the State of the Union. Mm-hmm. And he says to, you know, whoever is the, you know, guy that has to stay behind, do you have a best friend that's your chief of staff? And Leo is watching on. And there's something really interesting about that. There's also something like very idealistic about it. Having written about the White House a number of times, like, chief of staffs have the shortest life expectancy in the West Wing. They live, they basically keep their job for like a year and then they burn out. I think the longest serving was like 2.5 years, maybe 3. So like, that's maybe the most idealized role in this conversation. But I think what's really interesting about it is like, there is still a power dynamic. There is still very much a line that is drawn. And we see that in this. We also see a bit of misogyny and like, you're the man, which is one of the more that was like, as it was on my iPad, that was one where I was like, that's a,
it just doesn't feel like Bartlett to me.
It doesn't feel like Bartlett, but there are times where he like is very, you know, old school. And there's those episodes later in, I think, season 2 or season 3, when they're doing the flashbacks, and Lawrence O'Donnell is playing his father, which is like one of my all-time favorite cameos. And like, his dad is like a really hard ass and, you know, hits him and is in all of this. So like, there's like elements of that that are kind of woven through, but it does feel very much, this episode felt very much like they were trying to figure him out. Like, they hadn't totally figured out Bartlett, and they hadn't totally figured out the dynamic between Leo and Bartlett.
I completely agree with you. It felt like what they wanted was the scene at the end with Bartlett and Leo, right? Where Bartlett, you know, hat in hand, goes in and tells Leo, you know, I'm sorry, and I shouldn't have said that. And Leo accepts his apology. And that's where they wanted to get to. I'm not necessarily sure they had to go as far as they went in the Oval Office scene, where Bartlett feels so... I mean, annoyed's the wrong word, but almost like hurt by the accusations and like, or not the accusations, but the situation.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I think that's like, there's a couple of elements that really feel like what they're dancing around makes sense. And it's like, you know, when Leo says, I didn't want you to blame yourself.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Bartlett's like, well, are you saying it's my fault? And there's, it feels like there was a version of that scene, which very much was reactionary, that you know, Bartlett was blaming himself and he knew that this was his fault ultimately, you know, not necessarily him as a man, but him as the office and sort of in a global sense, and the sort of shame and blame and like guilt that he has for that. And it feels like that's a really interesting scene that I would love to see, but it does, it's kind of that one line that skews, which is like, you're the man, fix it, is like a really like 1950s, you know, statement to make. And I also think one of the problems is that we haven't met Stucker Channing yet. And like, so we haven't established his role as a husband. We've seen him as a father, but we haven't seen him as a husband, which like, wow, want to get to that later. But we haven't like talked about, haven't seen him. And the second that Stucker Channing shows up on the show is like, oh, Bartlett totally makes sense. It's like, oh, okay, I get him. This woman is running his life, and like, he may be the president of the United States, but he does not actually make any decisions. And there's like, that really works well. What's interesting about him though is the one relationship that I feel like they did totally nail from the beginning is his relationship with Toby. Like, even that moment at the poker table, that's so brief when they're going at each other and he's quizzing him and things like that, that, which in a lot of ways, that relationship is like the heart of, as well as it becomes sort of, as like Leo and Bartlett are kind of brothers, Toby very much is like the son and the child of this administration. And we're going to ignore the devastation that happens later. But that's like interesting that I didn't realize how early that was set up, how early the sort of like competitiveness and the almost like that Toby's the only one that can tell him to like shut the fuck up and move on. I didn't realize how early that was set up.
I mean, it's even earlier. They have the basketball pickup scene outside the White House. And
that's
Toby
right.
calling him out for all that shit then. So it's like, it is, I totally agree with you that the Bartlett-Leo relationship is one the Bartlett-Toby relationship is one that fascinates me in terms of how drastically dissimilar their upbringing is. Both have, you know, tricky relationships with their fathers. And that Toby is one of the only people that really calls Bartlett out on the things that he does. You know, I've alluded to this in the past a little bit, but, you know, I'm fascinated with the relationship, that relationship, and also the relationship between Tony Soprano and Melfi. These powerful men that have these people that are inside their heads and resent the fact that they need people inside their heads to function for all intents and purposes. I think it's really interesting. And I think that Toby, I love the poker scene at the top of the episode. I mean, I love whenever they play poker on this show. Aaron Sorkin, an avid poker player. And just the way that... I mean, there's the humor of it, obviously Bartlett filibustering the poker game and fucking with everybody with trivia, but that Toby doesn't go for it, that Toby has all the answers, that Toby never takes the bait for all intents and purposes.
But he does take the bait. That's the thing, is that like Bartlett is able to finally stump him. I think that's ultimately the thing. And that's what I do really like about the place that where Toby and Bartlett's relationship goes, is the thing about Bartlett is he is the smartest person in the room. Always. Like, no matter what, he is always the smartest person in the room, which very much felt like they were trying to figure out how to make, like, the nerd president work and like, make him not a know-it-all, but also it's Martin Sheen who, like, feels charming as a know-it-all. Mm-hmm. And, like, so it's interesting that they're trying to figure that out, but that ultimately is what the argument is sort of between Toby and Bartlett as they go on in the relationship, is that Toby is like, you're afraid of being smart. You're afraid of coming off as a Nobel Prize winner and all of these things. And like the fact that he's an economist is one of my favorite things, because it's like the nerdiest possible Nobel Prize you could win. By the way, not knocking it in any way. Like, I also went to art school. So like a con to me is like, I open my wallet and that's what that means. Like, I don't understand the nuances. Yeah. But the fact that like Bartlett is an economist is hilarious to me.
I even love when they call him out on being folksy at one point. It's like, yeah. I am folksy. Like, that is who I am. Like, I think that stuff is, I agree with everything you're saying in terms of that there's all these layers to the Bartlett character. He really is an onion that they're constantly kind of peeling away and showing things. The next episode is the one where they introduce Abby, played by Starker Channing. And I had Joe Reed on to talk about it. It's such a great episode. But it's fascinating to me. She had no backstory. She had no idea what she was walking into. She was pulled out of a movie to do basically, you know, 5 days of work on this show for all intents and purposes. She didn't even, you know, the first scene she has with Martin Sheen, they'd never met each other before.
I love that. That was crazy. Like the first time they met. Yeah. It's great.
And you know, Stalker's talked about how the prickliness that exists in Abby is actually her frustration in not knowing enough about the character, which is just tremendous to think about how like these bearing walls in a character that I've loved for so long are just basically an actor that's annoyed.
It's great. And her, like where her character goes, particularly in those first four seasons, is so interesting. And like it's interesting because there is a very patriarchal conversation to be had about the West Wing in general. And the show and the actual place in real life. And there's something to the fact that, you know, Jed is the one that lies ultimately, you know, I guess, spoiler alert, but like, seriously, if you're fucking listening to this.
Yeah, if you're listening to this, you've watched the show.
Yeah. But, you know, he's lied about his Parkinson's and he has to get censured and everything. But Abby is the one who loses her license and Abby is the one who's not able to work. And there is the moment, I do think they address it very well, where it's like they don't talk about it, but it's very clear that she's like, this is not right. You know, that's not right. But like, this is the only way for us to get through this and to move on is if I do this. And the sacrifice that women are forced to make when their husbands are in the positions of power or their spouses are in the positions of power, I think is a very interesting conversation that, though some of the dialogue and conversations in 99 feel dated, I don't think has changed very much in 2021. And I think, you know, we're having the conversations more, but, you know, I saw something recently on like a gossip website, which is so stupid, but they were talking about a male actor and they're like his wife and his, like his wife is a television star. And I was like, guys, like, come on. Like, I know it's a paparazzi photo and it doesn't fucking matter, but like, get, like, she has a name. Let's just like, she's just as famous as him.
Yep.
But so it's, you know, it's this gender balance and gender power struggle that shouldn't be a power struggle. That should just be.
I agree. Know. There's the, you know, one of the lines in season three when Bartlett and Leo are watching the hearing when Abby's going to lose her license and Bartlett says the things we do to women.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the show recognizes it in its own way at a time when I guess it felt it could in its own way do that. We haven't come far enough. That goes without saying. But speaking of patriarchy, it feels like this might be the right time to talk about Josh and Donna, which does have a patriarchal kind of vibe to it. I mean, I do think that in its own way, Donna does have power over Josh in a way. Mm-hmm. Like I know she is his assistant. It doesn't bump me as much as it might otherwise had Donna's character not grown a spine as quickly as she did and sort of keeps Josh in line for all intents and purposes. But in this particular episode, she's frustrated about the budget surplus and she wants her money back. It's a very kind of classic Donna cute runner where she pops in from time to time and talks about why she feels she can spend her money better than the government can. And it
I mean, by the way, preach.
Yeah, seriously.
Like, come on. Talk about things that are relevant.
I will say, though, I did appreciate that it comes full circle at the end when she buys sandwiches for everybody with Josh's money and doesn't give him the change and says, I can spend your money better than you can. It's a nice kind of full circle.
I think it's interesting. It does not bump me as much as other people. I think, A, for the fact that she is his assistant, like, that is her role. Yeah. And the other is that they didn't plan for her to be a character. You know, it was that Janelle Maloney, like, was such an incredible actor and gave a great performance. And she and Whitford had such great chemistry that that role grew ultimately into one of the leads of the show. So I think it's, you know, it's, again, we're talking about, what is it, episode six of season one? Like,
seven.
We're talking about the first 7 hours of a television show. Like, I can tell you that you're still barely, like, you barely know who your main character is at this point. So, like, I do think they figure it out again as they go. And I think you're right. I think very quickly she does grow a spine. And you sort of see that at the end with the, like, I can spend your money better than you can.
And it also just feels like, I mean, listen, broadcast television, as you very well know, very different from cable and streaming and premium and all the various facets that exist now. So, you know, the show finds a formula and it finds a rhythm for itself, as shows have to on the fly, essentially, as they're being made when you're doing broadcast television. Donna fulfills, not only is she a great character, but she also fulfills a role of explaining things to the audience when things need to be explained. You know, this is just the nature of a broadcast show that just people don't think about, which is...
It really did tell me the difference between Democrats and Republicans about the surplus, though. I was like, fuck. But I was with the good guys. Like, give me my money back.
Seriously. I also think, you know, you mentioned the essentially Donna swallowing Mandy and essentially killing Mandy's character, which
R.I.P.
Yeah. Mandy
also fine. Like, I, you know, it's, and it's no fault of that actress whose name is
Moira Kelly.
Thank you. Topic, one of the greatest performances of all time.
Yeah, she's great.
She's amazing. I think it's just there were too many characters. There are too many characters on that show. I was just watching something recently that I was completely lost on me. That's another ensemble show. And like, as the show went on, they continued to add characters. And so it became diluted. And like, by season three, I was like, what are we watching? Like, I don't even know which storyline I'm supposed to be interested in. There's too many characters. And it kind of felt like that. It feels like a very networky note, which is like, we need all these different people. And then, you know, by episode sort of 7, 8, 9, 10, you figure out like, these are the characters that have chemistry. These are the characters that we're interested in. These are the actors who are really, you know, working with the material. I think Leo's daughter also is somebody who was a surprise, like that, like she, Mallory, she like really had great chemistry with Sam. And then I was always very bummed that she didn't last, like that she didn't come back. Cause she
Same
was
with
such
Ainsley
a,
Hayes. I mean, she also had great chemistry.
Ainsley, oh, RIP. I love Ainsley. Ainsley had some of my favorite episodes of all time. The episode where she locks herself in the closet trying to hide from the president. I talk about often. It is, I have done that in real life, not trying to be Ainsley Hayes, but like hiding from somebody that I very much admired and like ended up locked in a kitchen. But I couldn't like come out because I was like, I've just chosen this moment. Like I'm here. I'm just.
That's fantastic.
So it's very real to me, but yeah, it's, I mean, but also talk about idealized. She's a very idealized Republican.
Yes. I mean, I'll say, I agree with you too, that there's this sort of, this show does a good job of figuring out who its core is mm-hmm. and kind of sticking with it until Aaron Sorkin leaves and John Wells does what John Wells does. Disrespect to John Wells, but the pool starts to expand. You know, he did it on ER as well, quite successfully, of sort of revolving door of cast and what have you. But some shows, you know, can do this sort of Dickensian, like mm-hmm. The Wire is a good example of just like having a million characters that all mm-hmm. coexist, and it's done seamlessly. It's just a very, very, very hard thing to do.
I just watched a couple months ago. I watched all of For All Mankind, which is like
I love.
I know we exchanged emails about it. Yeah. It's like I know people have talked about it, but I'm just like, how does nobody talk about this more? It's one of the best shows I've seen in years. I can't believe it.
Good. Yeah.
But talk about being able to balance an ensemble and find ways to not have you miss characters when they're gone for episodes, and then have them back, and you're like, oh, this is great. And then, I mean, truly, if you haven't watched this show, watch it. And like, you can't even talk about
it's the heartbreaker at the end of season 2, let me tell you. But
also, interesting correlation, Coral Pena, who's on that show, is also in The Post. So very exciting little shout out there.
I knew her. Yeah, yep. Is she the one that talks to Meryl at the end? Yep. That's awesome. Yes.
She plays a character named after my mom, which is very exciting.
That's awesome.
But shout out to Nance.
But I think that For All Mankind does something too, which is, again, a symptom of how television has changed and evolved, is that that show has, I mean, if the showrunners are to be believed, and they should be, has sort of this like 6 or 7 year plan of not being about just these people. It's really about the planet and space exploration, similar to something like The Crown, for instance, where you're taking this like 30,000 foot look at something much, much larger.
I think with The Crown though, with The Crown though, you do have an endpoint. Like, you know that you're going to do whatever, mm-hmm. 6 or 7 seasons, however many they're doing mm-hmm. of that. And you're like, okay, we're working towards that. With The West Wing, what's interesting is, like, you know, and Sorkin's talked about this, is that he burned through 4 seasons of story in 24 episodes, which also, is it 24 or 27 in the first season? It's something 24. Like absurd, 24, which is absurd. Yeah. The fact mm-hmm. that I just did 8 episodes of television and I'm like, I'm going to go nap for a year. I can't believe that somebody, my husband also works in television and he's a writer producer. He on one year, we call it the year in the cave. He did 20, I think he did 26 episodes because they were doing like, they were doing 2 seasons back to back. They were doing like A and a B season. I mean, it's just, at a certain point you're like asking people on the street for pitches. You're just like, I have nothing left.
It's crazy. I wrote a pilot with someone who wrote on Gossip Girl. And Gossip Girl was doing 26 episodes, 25 episodes, where you're just like, of a season of television, we're just like, I agree with you. What are we even talking about anymore? I mean, through that season, you're just like, I'm out, I'm done, I'm spent. I don't know what.
And there's also like, as a viewer, I mean, I think that is what is one of the most remarkable things about season 1 of West Wing, is there's maybe 1 or 2 episodes in here that you're like, okay. You know, like that are like, those are fine. Mm-hmm. Usually on these long run 22, 24, 26 episode mm-hmm. series, there's like 10 that you just don't give a shit about, that you're like, I'm just burning through this to get to the next episode. Like that on reruns, yeah. They never show. Like there are episodes mm-hmm. that have never been seen. Yeah. We rewatched Friends during the pandemic, and there are episodes mm-hmm. in there that I was like, this has never been rerun.
Yeah.
This has never been rerun. Yeah. And it's like, it's just because it was a 22 episode season. There were 10 seasons of it. Like there's going to have episodes like this. The first season of Watchmen is so tight that right. like, it's just, it's crazy, but it's also used truly at least 3 years of plot in 24 episodes.
For sure. I want to talk about CJ for a second, because I'm very curious about your thoughts on CJ, which I do think evolved into one of Aaron Sorkin's greatest characters, but starts from a place of one of Aaron Sorkin's greatest weaknesses, which is writing female characters.
Women that, falling down.
I was going to say that are introduced falling on a treadmill. So I this episode in particular, CJ doesn't really get much of a storyline. The storyline is CJ doesn't know anything about the census, and she learns a bunch about the census from Sam. So this is an episode that shows the weaknesses of the CJ character up top. But you know, in the next episode, you really sort of get to bolster the Danny Kincannon relationship that ultimately turns into something significant for the series. And I do think that CJ becomes a much more fleshed out character, whether or not it's because Allison Janney sort of really comes into her own to some degree, or really sort of imbues the character with the fortitude and the three-dimensionality. But what do you think about CJ in season one, and sort of how her progression over the course of the series?
I love CJ. I know that there is a large hubbub of people in the world that don't think Sorkin writes female characters well in general. I viscerally disagree with that, and I'm super excited for all the Twitter hot takes I'm going to get after this goes out. I just do. I mean, I think, yeah, she falls on the treadmill. To be honest, I broke my hip putting pajama pants on, so like, I'm not the best barometer of like, you know, how people can injure themselves really easily.
Sounds terrible.
Oh, it was awful. It was truly awful. It was a horrible experience. But like, her introduction isn't great. Mm-hmm. She falls in the pool later in the I think it's in the premiere of season two when they do the flashback episode. Some people are klutzy, just is what it is. Like, I actually really like that that's part of CJ's character, because she is so put together. She is the face of the face of the franchise. She's the face of the West Wing. You know, she's the face of the government. You know, I think there's a very human aspect to her klutziness. I think her evolution is very good. I think where she starts, you know, I like that she is, you know, given the comedy in this episode where she's like, I'm playing it fast and loose. Does it bum me out that it's the press secretary and the only female lead on the show who doesn't understand what the census is? Yes, that's kind of a bummer. Yeah. But I also, again, as we were saying earlier, it's episode 7. They haven't figured everybody out yet. They're figuring her out. And I think by the time we get to the end of this season, and then, you know, as we progress by season 3, when she has the whole storyline with Mark Harmon and all of that, like, she is incredible. And I think she won the Emmy that year, and she's, you know, she's amazing. I do think it's an interesting conversation of like, what would that character be in somebody else's hands? Because Allison Janney is such a singular actress and such a singular performer that, you know, I talk about it a lot in my work and when working with people, is you can't just be an actor that does drama. You have to, at least in my opinion, have timing and understand comedy, because it makes everything.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Human and relatable, and even if it's a super unique situation, if you get somebody to laugh, they'll cry and things like this. And Allison Janney has that ability to make us feel very warm and comfortable. And though it is a bummer she's the woman who's learning about the census, at the same time I was like, tell me more, Sam. I agree. Like, I don't get it, you know? Like, yeah. So I, you know, there is, I mean, and I think, you know, look, with an ensemble of, I think, like 11 people at this point, you're going to have a push and pull. And she gets, you know, to drink the grasshopper, which we still didn't see. I'm really bummed.
I mean, I agree with everything you're saying. I think that that her comedic timing makes us love her so much more. I mean, it goes without saying, you know, your comedic influences make an audience, you know, if they make you laugh, you make them love them. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just that simple. But I will say this. I do think that in this particular episode, she does serve a purpose, if only to explain mm-hmm. the census stuff, which works out. Her and Rob Lowe have a really great banter. They've got mm-hmm. a really great relationship. I love the whole, you're very good at this, Sam.
Yeah.
It's just all and I love, is really great.
She has a great relationship and really does feel like she ties everything together. Yes. Because she is a part of everybody's lives, but mm-hmm. not necessarily tied to one in particular in the way that Leo and Bartlett are really tied together, or the way that Whitford and Rob Lowe feel very tied mm-hmm. together at times, or Donna. Like, Allison Janney very much feels like the center of the web. Her mm-hmm. relationship with Toby is one of my favorite relationships. Yes. And like their weird flirtation that you're always mm-hmm. kind of like, are they flirting?
Are they?
Yeah. Like,
have they slept
together before? Is that something
yes.
that happened?
Yes, yes.
Am I crazy?
Yes.
And so like there's this really beautiful relationship. And then, you know, I think there's a lot of value in how she is kind of, they're still kind of figuring her character out in these first few episodes, because then when she fucks up, when she's in the middle of a press briefing and mm-hmm. she closes her door and screams like mm-hmm. that, when she's sort of isolated from the West Wing because mm-hmm. of her screw ups, it's mm-hmm. really great. And I think she is forced to stand up for herself and ask for respect, totally. Which I think is better than if, you know, I think it's better to watch that evolution, at least for me, and was a more interesting character then, unfortunately, Mandy, RIP again. But I was also like going to other female characters in the show. Is like Mary Louise Parker, when she shows up, it's like, oh, God bless.
The best.
Oh, the best. Another one that I'm like, why, where did you go?
Amy Gardner.
I know you had to be the star of your own show. It's fine. But like, couldn't you just come back for a little bit longer? I was just like, oh.
Yeah, she was tremendous. I another female character that is worth talking about is Zoe. And I want to kind of unpack mm-hmm. this a little bit because it leads to the bar stuff.
Leads to the end of season four, almost.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes. It's literally, he tells her the nightmare scenario, and the nightmare scenario is the end of season four. But I there's this sort of kind of, I don't want to say clumsy, but a little too cutesy scene with Zoe and Mallory and Josh in the hallway. They hear that Bartlett has asked Josh to take Charlie out for drinks so that he feels sort of, you know, social and what have you. And they want to come with. And it's just a little too cutesy the way that it's played. I don't know if you felt similarly. But it's just like Mallory's got a crush on Sam, and like it's all this, like, I don't know.
It didn't really actually feel cutesy for me for Zoe, because Zoe's 18. So I was like,
sure.
I was like, Mallory, you're 35 years old. I was like, that was a little bit, yes. or 30, whatever. But yeah. So like, I was also like, Mallory, you're 30 and you're hanging out with an 18 year old. Like, you know, I mean, yes. Zoe's dope. She's super cool.
Yes. Yes.
And I'm not being ageist in any way, but like, mm-hmm. that is where it became a little cutesy to me. I love Zoe as a character, you know, Elizabeth Moss. She's the best. It's also like, I guess if you want a show to be a massive hit and for everyone to love it, put Elizabeth Moss in it. because like Mad Men, The West Wing, Handmaid's Tale. Yeah. It's like, good Lord.
It's crazy.
And by the way, rightfully so, she's exceptional. But it's interesting watching her evolution as well. And this is sort of what, this is like her second episode, right? Because the Chili episode is her first one. Yeah. It's interesting. And she's not as utilized in this episode, but I think it's sort of like the process of getting to know her.
I agree. And the process of the relationship between Zoe and Charlie and, and where that goes, you know, they basically, Josh, Charlie, Zoe, CJ, Mallory, and Sam go for drinks at some Georgetown bar. A couple of guys played by Eric Balfour that you mentioned, who I loved on 6 Feet Under. Basically these guys start harassing Zoe at the bar. Charlie clocks it, goes to investigate and try to sort of, defuse the situation. Things get racist and homophobic, and it's a crazy thing to think that like NBC was okay with airing this type of stuff ever.
The other crazy thing to me is like, okay, so they went out for drinks after work. This is like 6:30 p.m. Where have you guys been? Getting loaded off your asses. Like it's that I'm like, this is not. But there, I mean, and not to divert from the racism and homophobia that is extremely explicit.
Yeah.
But it's like, they're so drunk in this scene that it was very, I was actually like, that kind of took me aback a little bit before even getting to the racism and homophobia. Cause I was just like, what time is it? Like where? Yeah. I thought we'd like just left the office. Even if it's 8:30, it's like, you guys haven't even had dinner yet. I mean,
yeah, it strains believability on a bunch of levels, unfortunately, which is sort of, you know,
the part thing of for it, me. Yeah.
Yeah, please.
I was just saying the thing about the racism and homophobia is it does not particularly surprise me that this was on network television in 1999. I mean, I think we look at what's been on network television in 2021 or, you know, in the last 10 years. Unfortunately, it's not that surprising to me. I think what was surprising to me was how overt it was and how graphic it was. It was really like, I guess it's not surprising to me that a level of racism and homophobia was used in this scene in particular because of everything that was happening. And it's not surprising to me that that made that to air, but the level of it in this scene is quite, intense.
It's pretty visceral. Like it hits you on a gut level in a way that I was surprised about, which by the way, I mean, isn't necessarily a bad thing. I'm obviously against everything that's said in the scene. And yet at the same time, I did find myself going, there are people that believe this still to this day. Yeah. And it's very upsetting.
Yeah.
But that adds to the drama of the scene. Like I'm sort of, do you know what I mean? Like there's this push and pull going on in my head.
But it's also, it feels like so much. It was how bad of a guy does Eric Balfour have to be? Yes. It was like, he's sexually harassing a young woman and physically blocking her from leaving. Mm-hmm. He's racist. He's homophobic. And he has an 8-ball of blow in his pocket. It was like,
how many hats does Eric Balfour's character need to be wearing?
I mean, it was really arch. It was very mustache twirly. And so like that was for me, it was like, whoa. Like there also was a weird thing that happened in it that felt very network notey to me. So I wonder if this whole scene was actually like, we have to make him worse and worse or something. I have no idea. But there's a moment that has always felt very strange to me. One is the shot of him picking up the beeper or the panic button, which is fine. Like we're establishing he's picked up the panic button, right? Whatever. But it's super obvious. It's like we pan down and it's like, whoa, let me go get this panic button that we just spent a minute describing what it is. Yes. And then after they get arrested by the Secret Service, he like throws it up in the air. Whitford throws up in the air and catches it. And he's like, my job here is done. And it feels like the least Josh Whitford thing of all time. And truly feels like a network note of like, well, how do we know who called the Secret Service?
I
don't know how to answer. That's one of those things that you're like, you're right. I don't know how to answer that. I don't, you know, as a writer, you're like, okay.
It's a clunky scene for sure in a bunch of ways. I agree with you that it feels network notey. which is part of it too. Like, it's so dialed up that you're kind of like, what are we doing here? It gets us to the scene with Bartlett and Zoe and him laying out for her why it's so important, which tees up not just season four, but tees up the assassination attempt that happens at the end of season one. Like, it's doing a lot of work. So I'm okay with it on a plotty level, but I agree with you that it's just like, there's just so much in it. It's a lot.
It also, like, I really do think Sorkin writes women in general very well. And it is also a scene that for me was very much written by a man. Like, you can tell for me as a woman, like, that it was written by a man. If I was Zoe, and I can say, like, pretty much a blanket statement for any woman, that, like, if I was Zoe and I was feeling it, if I was physically incapable of getting away and my friend was there and there were four other guys over there, two other guys over there who are friends of mine, and by the way, not to mention that I'm also the president's daughter, I would have been like, motherfuckers, get out of here. Like, what are you doing? Like, are you out of your minds? I will kick your dick in. Like, move. Like, that to me, because they felt so actually not threatening in a way, like, that there was a physical barrier and all that, but there are ways to that I have been threatened as a woman, or that I felt physically threatened as a woman, that are way less arch, that are way more terrifying, that is what felt like very inauthentic to me because it was written by a man, because it was written by somebody who really had not felt threatened in that way because of their gender. And that was hard for me to sort of wrap my head around. And it was also a little bit like, you know, like, don't make Zoe seem stupid. You know, it's right. You know, we can all make mistakes and things like that. But, like, truly, a certain point, when they're like, I don't know who you are, she says, like, are you joking? It really feels like there's, like, one more sentence after that where it's like, guys, I'm the daughter of the president of the United States. The Secret Service are outside. You may want to rethink your life choices right now. Like, just a hint. Yes. Like, all the vagaries, you know, once they start being extremely racist and homophobic to Charlie, I love that he's just like, I'm going to watch this and love it because, fuck you guys. But just, like, before I guess that point, I was like, it was just a little forced to me.
I also just didn't love that CJ and Mallory are, like, receded in the background. We get, like, one shot of them just kind of, like, watching. It's like, I don't know, all this sort of stuff where you're just like, it all just feels very 99. Unfortunately, I think if the scene was shot and written today, it would be very different in a bunch of different ways.
I just have to add something, because, like, when you said that CJ and Mallory are, like, in the corner, I just had the image of the scene in Endgame when, like, all of the female superheroes come together. And I was like, oh, if this was made now, it would be like CJ and Mallory, like, come stand behind her. And they're like, we got this.
Exactly.
It's so funny. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Anyways,
I want to just talk about the titular Mr. Willis. Our essentially, I don't want to say it's the A story, but it does feel like it's obviously the meat of the episode in a lot of ways. I liked this storyline for a bunch of reasons. The actor that portrays Mr. Willis, his name is Al Fan, is tremendous in it. It's a really beautiful storyline. His wife has passed, and he is standing in for her, essentially, for a vote on who should be counted for all intents and purposes, like how we do a census. It becomes a hallmark of the show of Toby coming into a situation with a very Toby mindset, and then someone turns him around, and by the end, sort of his heart grows three sizes. It's very Grinch who becomes, you know.
I mean, it's also in the pilot, you know, when he tells Josh that he has to apologize, and then he's she's calling us Jewish, you know, like, I think that's really, you know, I love that about, it's a very Sorkin thing, but I love that about Toby, that he, like, ultimately is like, no, I have to be right about this.
Right.
And sort of is the moral and ethical backbone of the show. Like, which ultimately, again, we won't talk about what happens.
But. We won't talk about how Toby's character resolves itself. But I'll just say that I do love that. So Toby comes into this. There are three Congress people. It's Mr. Willis and two other guys, two other white guys.
One of the guys is the gay congressman. From another episode.
Correct.
Which I think is also an interesting addition of him into the scene. Sorry.
Totally. No. But Toby sort of comes into it in a very Toby way, wind at his back, a copy of the Constitution in his pocket. And and sort of admits at the end to Mr. Willis after he changes his mind on the vote that there are flaws in his argument, specifically that it could lead to people thinking that we don't need to vote and that they can just be sampling and all that sort of stuff. And Mr. Willis has two phenomenal lines. The first is, it's okay by me as long as it's not the same people who decide who's on what's on television, which is amazing. And then also he says, the right place to start is to say fair is fair. This is who we are. These are our numbers, which in 2021, we are still not counting everybody, just to, you know, FYI.
Just to be clear. Yeah.
Just to be clear, we've learned nothing from this episode. But
John Lewis Act hasn't passed. Just FYI.
Just, yeah. We're still at a 50-50 split as of yesterday.
Yep.
We literally
as a country don't want people to vote. I just want that to be very clear. That is what this country is now.
Half, excuse me.
50% of this country. I mean the universal we, as 50% of this country, does not want the people of this country to vote, which is just, like, if you just say it as simply as that, is truly one of the most asinine fucking things I've ever heard. And, like, to call yourself an American or to call yourself, like, somebody who loves this country and not want people in this country to vote is truly abysmal. And you cannot talk about patriotism ever again to me if that's what you're saying. It's just a fact.
Could not agree.
And the fact that in 1999 we're having this conversation, you know, look, like, in the Post, we were really excited because we're making this movie about the first female CEO of Fortune 500 company, and we're like, oh, how things have changed. No, they haven't. It's like under 9% of Fortune 500 companies are run by, have CEOs that are women. I guess that's better than one, but, like, things do not change, it turns out. And
or very slowly is part of the problem. It does
or
feel
they,
like,
change and then they go back.
I was gonna say two steps forward, one step back is definitely a pattern for America. I mean, it definitely is. To underline your frustrations, you know, this idea that the Republicans know that if everyone votes, they lose.
Yeah.
So we can't count everybody. We can't let everybody vote. We have to gerrymander and we have to essentially cheat in order to hold on to what power we have left. There's an inevitability to it that I take some solace in, though. But anyway,
I mean, I don't have that solace, but I'm also.
You're also actually American and I'm Canadian, so there's that.
Well, there you go. But I think for me, it's also the crazy thing is it's like such a small percentage of the Republican Party. It's not actually the, you know, Nicole Wallace is one of my favorite pundits. Nicole Wallace was a Republican for a very long time, obviously is no longer, is, you know, I think Steve Schmidt, longtime Republican campaign manager for John McCain, you know, part of the Sarah Palin brain trust of putting her on the ticket, you know, very much not. So I think that's what is so scary to me is when the sort of born and bred Republicans are so on the side of Democrats, then what is the Republican Party now? And who are the Republicans who are terrified of losing it? And it's because they're terrified of facing reality that if everyone in this country votes, they will not be in power. Just FYI, just as a tip, that's a democracy. Just so you guys know that's how a democracy works. So sorry to let you know. So sorry to break that to you. But yes, going back to the episode.
The Mr. Willis character who I mean, I think that the heart of this storyline is listening, right? Mm-hmm. Like, listen to people's arguments, listen to people's thoughts, let it swirl around in your brain and come to your own conclusions on things. And that's what Mr. Willis does, which is so, what is so heartwarming about this storyline is he knows what Toby's doing. He's not an idiot. He completely gets it and understands and knows that he even admits it. Like, my wife was much smarter than me. He's just lovely. And just, he's like, you know, I this is the only vote I'm going to have. And I want to do the right thing. And we just wish that everyone in government had, you know, the wherewithal and the heart that Mr. Willis has.
Well, there's a lot in admitting, there's a lot of value in admitting you were wrong. There's a lot of value in changing your opinion. I think we as a country in general, regardless of politics, condemn people when they are wrong and condemn people when they make mistake. And rather than accepting that everybody's human and we all make mistakes, or we're all allowed to change our minds. Like, what is so wrong about deciding to change our minds because we've learned something? That's, you know, bananas to me. Is like, oh, I've learned more. Let me just completely stand my ground. That's wrong, that I now know is wrong. I think that there is so much value in learning and listening, as you said, and in empathy for people to change their minds, and empathy, and also in voicing your opinion and not changing somebody's mind, you know, and coming to the table and saying we're on equal grounds. And as Mr. Will says, fair is fair, and let's all talk about it, at sort of the same table. And ultimately, I might not change your mind, but I changed his mind. And, you know, I think so. But again, this goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning. It's like, this is ideal. Isn't this wonderful? It's like a wonderful scenario where...
But it's not an unreasonable one. Like, that's
completely
the thing.
Not unreasonable. I also feel like my husband's going to listen to this and be like, hashtag marriage. It's like, you know, I mean, yes, honey, I'm sure that I could learn to admit my wrongdoings much, much easier and faster. Sure. You know, so I fully admit I am part of the problem. I think... I think this is actually one of the more idealized scenarios plots in this episode to me. And also, like, how nice is it to hear a man talk about his wife being smarter than him? And how nice is it to, you know, I think it's also an interesting juxtaposition between the Leo and Bartlett story, because this is a man who has lost his wife, not out of divorce, out of death. Yeah. And his sort of appreciation and respect and how he feels about her, and the dichotomy of the conversation that happens between Bartlett and Leo is really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with everything you're saying. I want to piggyback on a little bit of what you were saying about how reticent we are to embrace people that change their minds on things. And obviously it's not just in politics. I mean, just look at film Twitter. You can't even change your opinion on a movie that you liked or don't like without everybody jumping all over you. It is really sad. Like, I find it, because I'm sure you're this way too, where it's like, there are all sorts of things that I didn't like when I was younger that I've rewatched and I have a whole new perspective. You evolve. We should be able to evolve. And when we can't do that, it's so limiting. Like, it's so frustrating to me, especially obviously in politics. You know, if you change your opinion, you're wishy-washy, you flip-flop. I mean, all these negative connotations to things, you know, where, I mean, I remember when, you know, when Obama ran in 2008, he was not for gay marriage. Because he saw that politically it wasn't advantageous for him to be so. He changed his mind when he saw that the winds were changing and all of that, but... Mm-hmm. Clearly, he was for gay marriage in 2008 as well. He just couldn't say it. But like, it's just all this type of stuff where you just get into these really tricky scenarios because of how rigid people's belief system is. It's really frustrating. Anyway,
I was gonna mention Obama as well. Actually, Ben Rhodes wrote this really amazing book that. The name of it is eluding me right now, but I will look it up. I'm so sorry, Ben.
No.
It is called The World As It Is. And it was about his 8 years with Obama in the White House. And in the first few chapters, there's a conversation where he was not close to Obama. He was, you know, sort of very far away, but he was in one of the first meetings and they were talking about how Obama was going to deal with the fact that he had changed his mind about the Iraq and Afghanistan war. And that Obama was really, people were like, just shut the question down, don't answer it, like, just avoid it. And Ben was like, how are you going to avoid this? Like, you changed your mind. Like, that is what it is. And like, avoiding the fact that you changed your mind is going to make this way worse. It's going to make it a way bigger story. And it's funny. It like reminds me of this scene in a very fictional movie called Clear and Present Danger, where Jack Ryan is talking to the president, and like the president realizes that one of his best friends was a drug dealer and like a money launderer for the largest cartel in Mexico, which we really blow by that storyline very easily in that movie. I feel like that would be a pretty big scandal now.
But
Jack Ryan tells the president, like, no, I think you should tell him like he's my best friend, like lean into the story. which for some reason in this movie works really well. I really feel like if Joe Biden's best friend out to be the biggest money launderer for the largest cartel in Mexico, and he was like, bad. Oh, he wasn't my good friend, he was my best friend, I would have questions. I would just be, I would be curious.
No, it's reasonable. It's reasonable.
You know, I just, thoughts. It's like, so Ozark? Like, he's literally Ozark. That's what we're talking about right now. Cool.
So the episode comes full circle with the staff playing poker again at the end. There's a great moment when CJ says, you can ask me anything about the census. And Bartlett says, how many people are in the United States? And she doesn't know.
Yep. I have an admission, which is I have like a terrible sense of population. My husband, the city we're in right now, my husband was like, there's 145,000 people here. I was like, big or small? Not sure. Like, I know, like,
that's small.
I understand it's small, but I was like, how small are we talking? Like, I know Los Angeles is millions. So like, I understand, but I knew that. My husband looked at me and he's like, this is not...
Like, it is hard to tell that, though. I mean, like, you're one person, right? Like, how do you sense that there's...
I look around, I see 50 people. I'm like, okay, like, you know, how much more do I multiply? So I don't know, but like, so it's also, but it's an interesting thing when you're talking about the census and you're talking about the population. Like, it is quite unquantifiable how many people in this country there are and have gone up since 1999. Like, that's the other thing that I, going back to politics, talking about the census and talking about, you know, we just dealt with this, so it feels very fresh, talking about voting and talking about voting rights and things like that is like, you know, I think there's a really interesting conversation we had of like, this is a country that is larger than most countries in the world. And we are all expected to fit in together and all agree with each other. And that is completely ludicrous. It's just not going to happen, which is why the census exists and why it should be done fairly. Because you are asking for representatives of where you live, of your values, of your beliefs, and they are intended to represent you. Otherwise, we get into the situation we're in now where you have fucking nitwits like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who literally don't understand anything, talking about, you know, I don't know, whatever they call it now, family values, whatever this is, that their new thing is. But you look at their constituency and you're like, you don't actually fucking represent anybody there. Like your constituents hate you. Yes. And so it's for me, there is, I don't know. I'm with CJ. I believe the census is wildly important. And I learned a lot.
I mean, it is wildly important. And we did just go through it. And admittedly went through it, obviously, during an inept administration. But it underlines just how important it was. I mean, watching, what was the guy's name? Wilbur something or other, the guy who was put in charge of the census under Trump.
Yeah.
Who literally is like the crypt keeper, like a million years old. And somehow siphoned like $60 million out of his time working in the White House. But like, it's just,
that's what they mean about civil service, by the way. FYI.
How much money you can get out of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so you just, and even then, even in 2021, I felt like getting across to people how important the census is was nearly impossible. Like, it's just,
absolutely,
people don't see how it has a direct correlation to your everyday life. It's just, it's,
well, it's also, I think, because, you know, it's interesting talking about the West Wing and how much it affected a population of their concept of politics and their involvement in politics and everything that's happened over the last, you know, 22 years since it premiered, how much more. You know, we go in these ebbs and flows, right? Where it was like in 2000, people were invested, but not invested enough. And look what happened. And then like, then in 2004, people were not invested and look what happened. And then in 2008, it was like, you know, it's sort of, we go through these ebbs and flows. And then in 2020, in 2016, where you see what happens. And then in 2020, you see what happens. And so like, you go through these ebbs and flows, but it does not feel like there is now a cultural touchstone that is sort of giving us this information, albeit idealized, but something that we can all wrap our heads around and be like, I really don't mean this in a demeaning way, but like in a Schoolhouse Rock way where your kids are sitting there learning about what the Bill of Rights is when they're 5 years old, you know, it doesn't feel like we have that now. And I think we're all like way dumber for it. And it's also, you know, it's going back to the Bartlett thing. And it's like about the Toby argument is he's afraid of being smart. We are now in this country being told that it's not good for us to be smart. That it's that we're too, if we're smart, then if we're educated, even if we're not educated, but if we're intelligent people, I don't equate education with intelligence or anything like that. So I'm not doing that. But we're being told is that if we are smart people, then we're the enemy. And if we read books, God for fucking bid, then we're the enemy. And that to me is such a, I mean, when you talk about things being politicized, like you're politicizing education, you're politicizing, like this country has one of the
vaccines,
worst.
Masks.
I mean, yeah, vaccines, masks, health. We're living through one of, we're still living through one of the greatest pandemics in the history of the world. Like this is, it's still happening, you know? And I, well, greatest pandemics in the history of the, no, it's in the history of the world. It's, yeah. It's, I was like in the history of the United States, for sure.
For sure.
For sure.
I agree with, obviously I agree with what you're saying. And I think that there's something to be said for two things quickly. The first is the splintering of television by and large, just the way that people watch television has changed drastically. We talked about just ratings and we talked about the way people, you know, watch stuff. There's that. So, and then mixed into that is a cynicism that I think is just maybe the worst thing to come out of this. Yes, the West Wing is over-idealized. I think we all can agree on that. But it also taught us something. It also hopefully gave us something to aspire to. And to your point, it feels like we're missing that right now. Part of that has to do with broadcast television has a universality to it. It's attempting to try to have as many people watching as possible. Now there's sort of a very kind of laser-focused, specific sort of demographic way the television shows are made. And thus, there's this jaded kind of quality that exists in that that I think is unfortunate and has led to your point, this vacuum when it comes to stuff like, and that's why, you know, we come full circle a little bit, but that's why For Whole Mankind, I think, is such a powerful show, because that show, to me, is incredibly hopeful. It's a show very much about the world that we live in today, even if it does take place in the 60s and 70s. And it's a show about potential. It's about human possibilities. So I couldn't agree with you more that we need something to fill that void.
It's, I'm going to quote another Sorkin show. there in on Studio 60, there is this episode where there's like, you know, a playwright trying to sell his pilot. There's a playwright trying to sell his pilot and it's getting bids and like it's between HBO and whatever the NBC, you know, is that they are, that they're not UBS, whatever it is. And Amanda Peet really wants it. And she says to him, and his pilot is about the UN, you know, and which is great. And the head of
no one would watch.
I mean, literally, like the head of the company, like the CEO comes later and he's like, great, I see like sweeps all over this. And but so it, which is kind of ironic because it feels like it's a little bit about the West Wing, like, you know, whatever. So it's like about the UN and she's like, this show is so great and da, 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 and it deserves to be on network television, not on HBO. It deserves to be seen by people for free for X, Y, and Z. And the reason I bring that up is because nobody's having that conversation anymore.
No.
Because for a multitude of reasons, not, you know, and just the evolution of creation and television and all of these things, network television does not have that anymore. And I do think there is something to be said about putting shows like For All Mankind or other, you know, shows that I've done or worked on things that you have to pay for versus something that is free for everybody. And I think that is absolutely a conversation, and sort of the West Wing is one of the last vestiges of that conversation.
Well, it's interesting too. You know, you talk about the paying and not paying, right? I mean, we're getting to a place where essentially cable as we know it is probably going to be gone in the next 10 to 15 years. You know, FCC regulations will no longer exist for all intents and purposes. So everything just changes at that point in terms of how people watch television, what's free, what's not. And to your point, I think that's not a good thing for television necessarily. So I'll be curious to see how it plays out.
No, and I think also when, you know, look, I work in television, and this is not, I love the ability to make so many different things and tell stories and, sure, and have very different audiences. But when you go on to Netflix and you have a curated list of things you want to watch, you are not forced to watch The West Wing. You are not forced to watch whatever, you know, but like we talk about, I think there's also been a, like, network television has been disparaged over the course of the last 20 years in particular, but you look at how things have changed. It's like the first kiss between two men happened on network television. Yeah. You know, the first time anybody said the word abortion happened on network television. You, the way that things change in some ways is through a cultural zeitgeist and through a moment. And that happens when 13 million people all watch it at once rather than I caught it on Netflix 5 years later. And so I think that is something that is really missing, particularly in this world where, you know, news has become news media, and on both sides. I'm not being sidesy on this. It is a reality show, you know, that we're living through. And so when you don't have that touchstone, be it, you know, be it Will and Grace, be it I Love Lucy, be it The West Wing, be it anything that is an issue that we're as a country dealing with, or we're as a world dealing with, that we can then sort of manifest and have a conversation about collectively, then yeah, I do think we take steps backwards and we become all very compartmentalized in our worlds. We watch the things that we feel fits our taste, fits our beliefs, our values, and we don't explore outside of it.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, everyone talks about the lack of a water cooler, but I think that is a real thing. The lack of cultural moments also breeds a lack of community, right? Like the idea of bringing a bunch of different people together to watch a specific thing, as opposed to like-minded people all, you know, in a vacuum watching a thing together that they're all going to like, and then just keep perpetuating the same stuff is a problem. Just to wrap this up, you know, Toby, at the end of the episode, everyone's playing poker. He watches Mr. Willis cast his vote. Makes me cry every time. If I had a nickel for every time an episode either ends or a scene ends on Toby, just like that curmudgeon face of his, and something lovely happening, and it just makes you melt. I mean, it's just, it's tremendous. I have one last question for you, which is, what is your favorite episode of The West Wing? Do you have a favorite episode? I know it's sort of a Sophie's choice. Are there a couple that jump out at you? Ones that feel, you know, that have stayed with you?
I made a list, so let me pull it up.
Okay.
Hang on.
That's no,
it's going to take me a minute.
No.
Okay. There we go.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. I'm just like analyzing it. It's interesting because, like, I think In the Shadow of Two Gunmen, part one and two in particular are, and then What Kind of Day Has It Been? So that sort of triptych, it's not one episode, but it's sort of like, it's, you know, the culmination of the first season. And then, and also kind of our kickoff of like, these are our characters and this is who they're going to be and who we love, is some of the most well-written television I've ever seen. And it's hard to not put that at the top, even though it's the most, for me, it's the earliest of the, of my favorites. Sure. So it's sort of a bit of like, you know, like favoritism in that it was just the first thing that I saw. And like, I remember just being blown away. So those, and also it was like, What Kind of Day Has It Been, which is a classic Sorkinism. But I, so those three, I think, are really important for me. I think in, honestly, probably the most emotional episode for me is Two Cathedrals, which I have had this argument with Josh Singer many times.
You wrote with a West Wing writer.
I did. I wrote with a West Winger. We have argued about favorite episodes, and I can't remember. I think his is Two Cathedrals and mine was In the Shadow of Two Gunmen. And then like we would switch and then we would argue about it. But, you know, Two Cathedrals just has so much and deals with Bartlett's faith in a way that I think is so fascinating. I'm sort of fascinated by Catholic presidents just because it's such a,
we have one.
We have one now. You know, it's so counterintuitive in so many ways to the office itself, and also so intrinsic to somebody's life. My one side of my family is very Catholic, and so it's like, it's just sort of personally fascinating to me. But his like fight with his faith is so interesting. And then obviously has like one of the best, in my opinion, one of the greatest music cues of all time. And like the pockets and everything is like, ugh. And also just like Mrs. Landingham. It's just like, oh, it's great.
Yeah. The most dad rock needle drop ever that works so beautifully.
Oh,
I want to talk about those two episodes very quickly. The In the Shadow of Two Gunmen is probably my personal favorite if I had to pick one. I just love getting to see how the team comes together. I'm a big fan of just like the fractured narrative of being able to see how all these people came into the Bartlett administration. I found that really satisfying as a, obviously mm-hmm. as a fan and as a viewer. And then for Two Cathedrals, you mentioned how it's Sorkin at the peak of his powers, perhaps with the most, we'll call it extracurricular activities in his system. But I also think that I remember watching the scene in the Oval Office when he's having the quote unquote fight with Mrs. Landingham. And when mm-hmm. it cuts to that wide shot and she's not there, and it was jarring, and mm-hmm. it was very theatrical, and mm-hmm. him arguing with God in a church, like this is all very, think about that. That's like 19, that's 2000. That's the year 2000. Mm-hmm. And a broadcast television show is doing something decidedly very unbroadcast, something mm-hmm. that's very theatrical and magic realism is playing into it to some degree or another. It's incredible that he got away with it, quite honestly, and that he got to do it, you know?
Well, at that point, you know, he's won like 19,000 Emmys and yeah, sure, 13 sure. million people are watching the seventh episode of this show on season one. So I feel like, yeah, he could probably do whatever he wanted. But I do think it's interesting because so many people talk about the dialogue of Sorkin is like, that's Sorkinese, right? Is that that's how we all know him. For me, it's actually those moments is that like he has an ability to build and find the moments that you know are going to come. Like you're not... The second that Mrs. Landingham in the flashback mentions, like you put your hands in your pockets when you're lying, or like when you're, you know, when you're about to, whatever it is, like when you're about to say something that's going to piss somebody off, whatever it is, you know, that's going to come back. And like, then when he walks up and you know, he's going to do it and it's like all of this, but it's so emotional. It's so well done. And like, it's something that he does for me. It's in the most powerful moments of all of his shows or all of his movies. It's like, you know, A Few Good Men is like, you know, if I had the option to have your father represent me or you represent me, I'd choose you every day and twice on Sunday. Or like in The Newsroom, the Rudy moment, or, you know, any of these things that are sort of like, even in shows that maybe weren't as successful as The West Wing, well, sure. none of his shows were as successful as The West Wing, but, you know, as sort of expressive, creatively full, well-rounded, there are those moments. And it's really, you know, I think that it's interesting also when you watch something that he has co-written, like Moneyball, he co-wrote with Steve Zaillian. There's like no fucking way in the world that Zaillian wrote that moment at the end when Brad Pitt's listening to his daughter and he's like deciding. It's like the most Sorkin moment of all time. And there's no dialogue in that scene. Yeah. So like that's, I think, you know, it's like everybody, let's all give, not like he's crying for a break. It's fine. He's fine. But yes. So anyways, I think that might be why Two Cathedrals probably wins out for me. And now Josh has won the 5-year argument.
Well, Liz, thank you so much for coming on to talk about The West Wing with me. I very much appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you. This is great. I get to come back and talk about In the Shadow of Two Gunmen?
Sure. You can come talk about any, whenever you want to talk about anything, but I very much appreciate you taking the time. I know that you're, you know, busy on many, many things, driving across the country with your trash dog and any number of other things, but
trash,
you know,
dog
that was just slightly overweight,
slightly overweight to be on a plane. She's 5 pounds.
But, I do very much appreciate it. And I look forward to talking again in the future.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
One last thing, please rate, review, and subscribe. Speaking of subscribing, check out our Patreon on all the best films of 1989, Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Fabulous Baker Boys, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, Field of Dreams, Major League, and many, many more. We are covering all the best films of 1989 with amazing guests like Joanna Robinson, Liz Hanna, Hunter Covington, Brian Cogman, David Iserson, and many, many more. All your favorite guests from our 1999 podcast are coming on to the 1989 Patreon. You can sign up for it at patreon.com/podcastlikeits1989. For only $5, you get access to all of these awesome episodes. And for a few bucks more, you get video of our 1999 episodes as well. Plus, there are other very cool tiers too, where you can even be a guest on our podcast. Also, please check out our Reddit as well at reddit.com/podcastlikeits. We're also on Twitter at podcastlikeits. We're also on Instagram at podcastlikeits. Thank you to Ernie and Will for producing our episodes, Sullivan for our social media, Jan Katas for our artwork and theme songs, and most of all, thank you all for listening. 1999, podcast like it. You want a podcast like it. 1999.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.